Underworld, Disc 4.
Chapter 3. We sat in the stadium club with our sour mash whiskey and bloody meat, pretending to watch the game. I'd been to Los Angeles many times on business, but had never made the jaunt to Dodger Stadium. Big Sims had to wrestle me into his car to get me here. We were set apart from the field, glassed in at press level. And even with a table by the window, we heard only muffled sounds from the crowd. The radio announcer's voice shot in clearly, transmitted from the booth, but the crowd remained at an eerie distance, soul moaning like some lost battalion. Brian Glassick said, "I hear they finally stopped ocean dumping off the East Coast." "Not while I'm eating," I said.
"Tell him," Sim said. "Describe it in detail. Make him smell the smell."
"I also hear the more they dumped in a particular area, the richer the sea life." Sims looked at the Englishwoman, who alone ate fish.
"Hear that?" he said. "The sea life thrived."
And Glassick said, "Let's eat fast and get out of here and go sit in the stands like real people." And Sims said,
"What for?"
"I need to hear the crowd."
"No, you don't.
What's a ball game without crowd noise?"
"We're here to eat a meal and see a game," Sim said. "I took the trouble to book us a table by the window. You don't go to a ballpark to hear a game. You go to see a game. Can you see all right?"
Simeon Biggs, Big Sims, was famous in the firm for his mid-body girth. He was fat, bald, and 55, but also strong, with a neck and arms resembling rock maple. If he liked you enough, he might trade chest thumps or invite you to race him around the block. Sims ran the operational end of our Los Angeles campus, as we called it, and designed landfills that were prettier than pastel malls. Glassick looked at me and said, "We need video helmets and power gloves, because this isn't reality. This is virtual reality, and we don't have the proper equipment." Sims said, "We can't take our drinks with us if we go to our seats." "That's a forceful point," I said. The only time I ate the wrong food, just about, or drank too much, if ever, was when I was out with Sims, who was a living rebuke to the tactics of moderation. The Englishwoman said, "Now, as I understand it, the pitcher gets a signal from the catcher. This pitch or that pitch, fast or slow, up or down. But what happens if he ardently opposes the catcher's selection?"
"He shakes off the sign," Glassick said.
"Oh, I see."
"He waggles his glove or shakes his head," Sim said, "or he stares down the catcher."
The Englishwoman, Jane Farish, was a BBC producer who wanted to do a program about the salt domes we were testing for the storage of nuclear waste under the direction of the Department of Energy. She'd been busy for some years devouring American culture, leaving the earth scorched with interviews, she said. Porno kings, contemplative monks, blues singers in prison. She'd just finished a sweep of California and was headed to a poker tournament in Reno, and then into the desert to interview Clara Sachs. The Dodgers were playing the Giants. Sims looked at Farish and said,
"You know, these two teams go way back. They were New York teams until the late 50s.
"They moved west, did they?"
"Moved west, taking Nick's heart and soul with them."
Farish looked at me. There was nothing left to take. I was already a non-fan by that time, burnt out. This is my first ball game in decades.
"And it turns out to be silent," Glassick said.
Big Sims ordered another round and told Farish about the old Brooklyn Dodgers. Sims grew up in Missouri, and he got some of it right, some of it wrong. No one could explain the Dodgers who wasn't there. The Englishwoman didn't mind. She was absorbing things chemically, sometimes shutting her eyes to concentrate the process.
"Nick used to take his radio up to the roof," Glassick said.
Farish spun in my direction.
"I had a portable radio I took everywhere. The beach, the movies. I went, it went. I was 16. And I listened to Dodger games on the roof. I liked to be alone. They were my team. I was the only Dodger fan in the neighborhood. I died inside when they lost. And it was important to die alone. Other people interfered. I had to listen alone. And then the radio told me whether I would live or die. It isn't easy to be smart about baseball if you didn't grow up with the game, but Farish asked decent enough questions. It was the answers that came hard. We must have resembled three mathematicians so lost in their highly refined work that they haven't noticed how quaint and opaque the terminology is, how double-meaninged. We argued the language and tried to unravel it for the outsider.
"Does anyone want wine?" Farish said. "I wouldn't mind trying a local white."
"Wine's a cop-out," Sims told her. "We clean toilets for a living." Glasic pointed out that an inning was an inning if we were speaking from the viewpoint of a pitcher getting three outs, but it was only half an inning in the broader scheme of a nine-inning game with top halves and home halves. And the same half inning is also two-thirds of an inning if the pitcher is lifted with one out remaining. I asked the waiter to get a glass of wine for our guest. Glasic returned to the paradox of the innings, but Big Sims waved him off.
"Let's go back to the Dodgers," he said. "We left the kid on the roof with his radio."
"Let's not," I said. "You have to tell Jane what ended your career as a die-hard rooter."
"I don't remember."
"Killed you so dead you never went back."
"These are local afflictions. They don't travel."
"Tell her," Sims said, "about the Bobby Thompson homer."
Farish looked politely hopeful. She wanted someone to tell her something that made sense. So Sims told her about Thompson and Branca, and how people still said to each other more than 40 years later, "Where were you when Thompson hit the homer?" He told her how some of us had stopped the moment and kept it faithfully shaped, and how Sims himself had gone running in the streets. A black kid who didn't even root for the Giants heard the game on good old KMOX and ran out of the house shouting, "I'm Bobby Thompson! I'm Bobby Thompson!" And he told Farish how people claimed to have been present at the game who weren't. And how some of them honestly insisted they were there, because the event had sufficient seeping power to make them think they had to be at the Polo Grounds that day. Or how else did they feel the thing so strongly in their skin?
"You're not saying like Kennedy. Where were you when Kennedy was shot?"
Glasic said. "When JFK was shot, people went inside. We watched TV in dark rooms and talked on the phone with friends and relatives. We were all separate and alone. But when Thompson hit the homer, people rushed outside. People wanted to be together. Maybe it was the last time people spontaneously went out of their houses for something. Some wonder, some amazement. Like a footnote to the end of the war. I don't know."
"I don't know either," Sims said. Farish looked at me.
"Don't look at me," I said.
"But you were on the roof, were you, when the blow was struck?"
"I didn't have to rush outside. I was already outside. I rushed inside. I closed the door and died."
"You were anticipating Kennedy,"
Farish said, and got a little laugh. The next day, I think it was, I began to see all sorts of signs pointing to the number 13. Bad luck everywhere. I became a budding numerologist. I got pencil and paper and wrote down all the occult connections that seemed to lead to 13. I wish I could remember them. I remember one. It was the date of the game. October 3rd, or 10-3. Add the month and the day, and you get 13.
"And Branca's number," Sims said.
"Of course, Branca wore 13.
"They called it the shot heard round the world," Sims told Farish.
"A little bit of American bluster?"
"Well, what the hell?" Sims said.
Glasic was looking at me in a strange way, almost tenderly, the way someone regards a friend who is too dumb to know he is about to be exposed.
"Tell him about the baseball," Glasic said.
He reached across the table and took some food from Sims' plate. Glasic was supposed to be my pal. I'd known Sims and Glasic a long time. And Glasic, freckled, freestyle Brian, a man of shambling charm, was the guy I talked to when I talked about something. I talked to Big Sims, but maybe I talked to Glassick more readily, because he didn't challenge me with his own experience. He didn't narrow his eyes as Sims did and fix me in his gaze. "Let's change the subject," I told him. "No, I want you to speak about this. You owe it to Sims. It's a crime that Sims doesn't know this. He's the only one here who still loves the game." Glassick turned to the Englishwoman. "I go to ball games when I go at all for the sake of keeping up. It's a fall from grace if you don't keep up. Nick has fallen from grace. Only Sims is completely, miserably in touch. We had the real Dodgers and Giants. Now we have the holograms." Farish said, "What baseball?" Sims was looking at me. He was finished with his food and was untubing a panatella, a simple exercise that he surrounded with detailed ceremony. Glassick gave me a final melting look and turned to Sims. "Nick owns the baseball, the Bobby Thompson home run ball, the actual object." Sims took his time lighting the cigar.
"Nobody owns a ball.
Somebody has to own it.
The ball is unaccounted for," Sim said. "It got thrown away decades ago. Otherwise, we'd know it."
"Simeon, listen before you make pronouncements. First," Glassick said, "I found a dealer on a trip I took back east some years ago. This guy convinced me that the baseball in his possession, the ball he claimed was the Thompson home run, was in fact the authentic ball."
"Nobody has the ball," Sim said. "The ball never turned up. Whoever once had the ball, it never surfaced. This is part of the whole, mythology of the game. Nobody ever showed up and made a verifiable claim to this is the ball. Or a dozen people showed up, each with a ball, which amounts to the same thing."
"Second, the dealer told me how he'd traced the baseball almost all the way back to October 3rd, 1951. This is not some fellow who turns up at baseball shows looking for bargains. This is pathological obsession, a completely committed guy. And he convinced me, to a probability of 99 9/10%, that this is the baseball. And then he convinced Nick, and Nick asked how much, and they worked out a deal."
"You got rooked," Sims told me.
I watched the Dodger shortstop field a grounder and make a wide throw to first. Glassick said, "The guy spent many years tracing the thing. He probably spent more money in phone calls, postage, and travel miles, I'm exaggerating, than Nick paid for the baseball." Sims had a derisive smile, a fleer, and it grew meaner by the second.
"Whole thing's phony," he told me. "If that was the authentic ball, how could you afford to buy it?"
"I will count the ways," Glassick said. "First, the dealer wasn't able to provide absolute final documentation. That cut the price. Second, this was before the market boom in memorabilia and the auctions at Sotheby's and the $400,000 that somebody paid for an itty-bitty baseball card."
"I don't know," Sim said.
"I don't know either," I said. Farish finally got her wine. She looked at me and said, "How much did you pay?" "My shame is deep enough. Let's not examine the details." "What shame?"
"Well, I didn't buy the object for the glory and drama attached to it. It's not about Thompson hitting the homer. It's about Branca making the pitch. It's all about losing."
"Bad luck," Glassick said, spearing a potato on my plate.
"It's about the mystery of bad luck, the mystery of loss. I don't know. I keep saying I don't know, and I don't. It's the only thing in my life that I absolutely had to own."
"A shameful secret?" Farish said.
"Yes. First, to spend serious money on a souvenir baseball. Then to buy it for the reason I bought it. To commemorate failure. To have that moment in my hand when Branca turned and watched the ball go into the stands. From him to me."
Everyone laughed but Sims. Glassick said, "Even his name, Somber Ralph Branca, like a figure out of an old epic, somber, plodding Ralph, slain in something-something dusk.
Dark arrowed, said the woman.
Very good. Except it's not a joke, of course. What's it like to have to live with one awful moment?
A moment in a game, she said.
Forever plodding across the outfield grass on your way to the clubhouse. Sims was getting mad at us.
I don't think you fellas see the point. The way he said fellas. What loss? What failure are we talking about? Didn't they all go home happy in the end? I mean, Branca's got the number 13 on his license plate. He wants us to know he was the guy. Branca and Thompson appear at sports dinners all the time. They sing songs and tell jokes. They're the longest-running act in show business. You fellas miss the point. Making us sound like scrubbed boys in preppy jackets. Branca's a hero. I mean, Branca was given every chance to survive this game, and we all know why.
A little paw fell across the table.
Because he's white, Sim said. Because the whole thing is white. Because you can survive and endure and prosper if they let you. But you have to be white before they let you.
Glassick shifted in his chair. Sims told the story of a pitcher named Donnie Moore who gave up a crucial home run in a playoff game and ended up shooting his wife. Donnie Moore was black, and the player who hit the home run was black. And then he shot and killed himself. He shot his wife several times, non-fatally, and then shot himself. He took a dirt nap in his own laundry room, Sims said.
Sims told this story to the Englishwoman, but it was completely new to me, and I could tell that Glassick barely remembered. I'd never heard of Donnie Moore, and missed the home run, and didn't know about the shootings.
Sims said the shootings came a few years after the home run, but were directly traceable. Donnie Moore wasn't allowed to outlive his failure. The fans gave him every grief, and there weren't any skits at the baseball dinners. Sims knew a lot about the shootings. He described the shooting of the wife in some detail. Farish shut her eyes to see it better.
"We hear what you're saying," Glassick said. "But you can't compare the two events on the basis of color."
"What else is there?"
"The Thompson homer continues to live because it happened decades ago when things were not replayed and worn out and run down and used up before midnight of the first day. The scratchier an old film or an old audio tape, the clearer the action, in a way. Because it's not in competition for our attention with a thousand other pieces of action. Because it's something that's preserved and unique. Donnie Moore... Well, I'm sorry, but how do we distinguish Donnie Moore from all the other ball games and all the other shootings?"
"The point is not what we notice or what we remember, but what happened," Sim said, "to the parties involved. We're talking about who lived and who died."
"But not why," Glassick said. "Because if we analyze the reasons honestly and thoroughly instead of shallow and facile and what else?"
"Unhistorical," I said.
"Then we realize there were probably a dozen reasons why the guy started shooting, and most of them we'll never know or understand."
Sims called us fellows again. I switched sides several times, and we ordered another round of drinks and went at it some more. We weren't talking to Jane Farish now. We didn't notice her reactions or encourage her interest. Sims called us fellows many times, and then he called us chaps. It began to get a little funny. We ordered coffee and watched the game, and Farish sat in a thoughtful knot, arms and legs crossed, body twisted toward the window, yielding to the power of our differences.
"Buying and selling baseballs. What heartache. And you never told me," Sim said.
"It was some time ago.
I would have talked you out of it."
"So you could buy it yourself," Glassick said.
"I deal in other kinds of waste, the real stuff of the world. Give me disposable diapers by the ton, not this melancholy junk from yesteryear."
"I don't know," I said again.
"What do? Take the ball out of the closet and look at it? Then what?"
"He thinks about what it means," Glassick said. It's an object with a history. He thinks about losing. He wonders what it is that brings bad luck to one person and the sweetness of good fortune to another. It's a lovely thing in itself, besides. An old baseball? It's a lovely thing, Sims. And this one's got a pedigree like no other.
He got taken big time, Sims said. He's holding a worthless object.
We paid the bill and started filing out. Sims pointed to a photograph over the bar, one of dozens of sporting shots. It was a recent photo of a couple of gray-haired ex-players, Thompson and Branca, dark-suited and looking fit, standing on the White House lawn with President Bush between them, holding an aluminum bat. We went out and sat in the company box for 10 minutes so Glassick could hear the crowd noise. Then we walked down the ramp and headed for the parking area. Farish had some questions about the infield fly rule. Sims and Glassick were able to get together on this by the time we got out to the car. It was an unexpected boon for the BBC. I sat in back and looked at the city flowing past, and I thought of Sims, the kid running down a street in St. Louis. He's wearing dungarees with the lower legs rolled into bunchy cuffs that are paler than the dark denim twill of the outer cloth. He's waving his arms and shouting that he's Bobby Thompson. Chapter 4. I sat with my mother in her room, and we talked and paused and watched TV. We paused to remember. One of us said something that roused a memory, and we sat together thinking back. My mother had a method of documentary recall. She brought forth names and events and let them hang in the air without attaching pleasure or regret, sometimes just a word. She spoke a word or phrase that referred to something I hadn't thought about in decades. She was confident in her recall, moving through the past with a sureness she couldn't manage to apply to the current moment or hour or day of the week. She made fun of herself. What day is it? Do I go to Mass today or tomorrow? I drove her to Mass and picked her up. This was the steadiest satisfaction of my week. I learned the Mass schedule and the types of Mass and the length of service, and I made sure she had money for the basket. We sat in the room and talked. She seemed untouched by sentiment. She'd summon a moment that struck me with enormous force, any moment, something ordinary but bearing power with it. Ordinary only if you haven't lived it, if you weren't there. And I saw how still she sat, how prudent she was in her recollecting. I used to tell my kids when they were small, a hawser is a rope that's used to moor a ship, or the hump in the floor between rooms, I used to say, this is called the saddle. We set her up with the dresser and the air conditioner and a hard mattress that was good for her back. She brought forth names from the family Passional, the book of special suffering, and we paused and thought. Her hair was still partly brown in places, gone wiry and iridescent, gold shot in bright light, bobby pinned, and we sat there with the TV going. I knew she wouldn't say too much or remember carelessly. She was in control here, guiding us safely through the pauses. After the riots in Los Angeles, my son started wearing baggy shorts and a cap turned backwards and sneakers with bloated tongues. Before this, he used to be nondescript, sitting in his room with his computer, a quiet kid just turned 20. He dressed the same way all the time. He dressed for a job interview the way you dress to walk your dog. It was one continuous thing to him. We designed and managed landfills. We were waste brokers. We arranged shipments of hazardous waste across the oceans of the world. We were the church fathers of waste in all its transmutations. I almost mentioned my line of work to Clara Sachs when we had our talk in the desert. Her own career had been marked at times by her methods of transforming and absorbing junk. But something made me wary. I didn't want her to think I was implying some affinity of effort and perspective. Famous people don't want to be told that you have a quality in common with them. It makes them think there's something crawling in their clothes. My father's name was James Costanza. Jimmy Costanza. Add the letters and you get 13. At home, we removed the wax paper from cereal boxes. We had a recycling closet with separate bins for newspapers, cans, and jars. We rinsed out the used cans and empty bottles and put them in their proper bins. We did tin versus aluminum. On pickup days, we placed each form of trash in its separate receptacle and put the receptacles, from the Latin verb that means receive again, out on the sidewalk in front of the house. We used a paper bag for the paper bags. We took a large paper bag and put all the smaller bags inside, and then placed the large bag alongside all the other receptacles on the sidewalk. We ripped the wax paper from our boxes of shredded wheat. There is no language I might formulate that could overstate the diligence we brought to these tasks. We did the yard waste. We bundled the newspapers, but did not tie them in twine. Sometimes we used the pauses to watch TV. We looked at reruns of The Honeymooners, and my mother laughed when Ralph Cramden flung his arms and bellowed great complaints. It was about the only time I could expect to hear her laugh. She must have felt a certain clean release, looking at the sadly furnished apartment, at wife Alice in her apron or dowdy cloth coat, at Norton the neighbor with a bent fedora on his jerky head. Things that were close to what she knew. Superficially, of course. Close to what she knew in an apparent rather than actual way. A closeness that was shallow but still a bit touching, and maybe even mysteriously real. Look at the picture on the screen, flat and gray and staticky with years, not unlike memories she carried to her sleep. She slept in a room in Arizona, and how strange this must have seemed to her. But Jackie Gleason on the screen made the place more plausible. He drew her toward a perceptible center. A hawser is the thing you tie around a bollard. I noticed how people played at being executives while actually holding executive positions. Did I do this myself? You maintain a shifting distance between yourself and your job. There's a self-conscious space, a sense of formal play, that is a sort of arrested panic. And maybe you show it in a forced gesture or a ritual clearing of the throat. Something out of childhood whistles through this space, a sense of games and half-made selves. But it's not that you're pretending to be someone else. You're pretending to be exactly who you are. That's the curious thing. Marion wanted to know me at 17, see me at 17. And there were small, shrewd things she asked about. And they talked about my father, and I listened in the deep lull after dinner. My mother said things I already knew, but I listened from the living room with a magazine in my face. He was a bookmaker, famous for his memory. Never wrote a number on a piece of paper. This was the legend of the street. I was 11 years old when he walked out the door, and I heard the story later, that he remembered everything, made his rounds of the barber shops and sweatshops, downtown, in the garment district, the street corners, the hotel lobbies, strictly small time, and that he never had to commit a figure to paper, because he was able to retain the details of every bet. This is the story that settled around his name. It was part of the awe that trails a violent death or an unexplained disappearance. She posed in the doorway in stately profile, and we turned off Interstate 10 and entered one of those death marathons of mall traffic, and finally found their little street, and there she was, pregnant to beat the band. My mother said things to Marion, a story now and then in her Bronxy half-brogue, and I sat and listened fitfully behind the body throb of the dishwasher. We gave her room a coat of fresh green paint, Lainey's old room, pale and restful. We fixed her up with the TV set and the resilvered mirror and the good, hard, healthy bed. And we laid in a case of flavored seltzer, lemon-lime, I think. In my office in the Bronze Tower, I made gangster threats that were comically effective. I said to a consultant who was late with a report,
I'm telling you once and for all that me, Mario Badalato, I'll sever your fucking family's head off.
This in a scraped, raw voice, faithful to the genre, and evilly appreciated by the others in the room. In Holland, I went to VAM, a waste treatment plant that handles 1 million tons of garbage a year. I sat in a white Fiat and went past windrows of refuse heaped many stories high. Down one towering row and around to another, waves of steam rising from the tapered heaps. And there was a stink in the air that filled my mouth, that felt deep enough to singe my clothes. Why did I think I was born with this experience in my brain? Why was it personal? I thought, why do bad smells seem to tell us something about ourselves? The company manager drove me up and down the steaming rows, and I thought, every bad smell is about us. We make our way through the world and come upon a scene that is medieval modern, a city of high-rise garbage, the hell reek of every perishable object ever thrown together, and it seems like something we've been carrying all our lives. He was the kind of person you'd have trouble describing if you saw him in the commission of a crime. But after the riots, he put on an L.A. Raiders hat and an ultra-long T-shirt that had a pair of sunglasses slung from the pocket. Nothing else changed. He lived in his room, disappearing into chips and discs, the same shy boy, but physically vivid now, a social being with a ghetto strut. We sat in the room watching reruns, my mother and I. He left her for a time before I was born. This is why I carry her name, not his. She didn't think he'd ever come back, and she told me she saw a lawyer who did some finagling. The courts tend to rule that a child must retain his father's name until he reaches legal age, at which time he can choose for himself. But the lawyer finagled an exception out of some judge, and this is why my birth certificate says Shay. Then he came back, and he stayed a long time before he went out for cigarettes. 10 years or so. He was a man from nowhere, she said, slightly resigned, as if this was all she could expect fate to offer us, her and me and my brother. Or maybe I misread the tone, and she meant this is where he came from and this is where he went, inescapably, given the rhyming slang of his life. Coming home, landing at Sky Harbor, I used to wonder how people disperse so quickly from airports, any airport. How you are crowded into seats 3 across or 5 across, and crowded in the aisle after touchdown when the captain turns off the seatbelt sign and you get your belongings from the overhead and stand in the aisle waiting for the hatch to open and the crowd to shuffle forward. And there are more crowds when you exit the gate, people disembarking and others waiting for them, and greater crowds in the baggage areas and the concourse. The crossover roars of echoing voices and flight announcements and revving engines and crowds moving through it all. People with their separate and unique belongings, the micro-history of toilet articles and intimate garments, the medicines and aspirins and lotions and powders and gels, so incredibly many people intersecting on some hot, dry day at the edge of the desert, used underwear fistballed in their bags. And I wondered where they were going and why and who are they and how do they all disperse so quickly and mysteriously. How does a vast crowd scatter and vanish in minutes, bags dragging on the shiny floors? I used to say to the kids, I used to hold up an object and say, the little ridged section at the bottom of the toothpaste tube, this is called the crimp. Gleason dead, but also in the room with us. Irish, like her, and camped in a stale sweatbox. Dressed in a busman's suit, arm-waving, flailingly fat, the only person who could make her laugh. He stalked across the floor, pumping his fist. You're going to the moon, Alice! My mother liked the familiar things best. The more often he used a line, the more she laughed. She waited for certain lines. We both waited, and he never let us down.
We felt more closely bound with Gleason in the room. He gave us the line, gave us the sure laugh, the one we needed at the end of the day. Gleason aggrieved, pounding the tabletop and bending his knees and tilting the great head skyward. He was the joke that carried a missing history. The fat joke, the dumb joke, the joke about the rabbi and the priest, the honeymoon joke, the dialect joke, the punchline that survives long after the joke is forgotten. We felt better with Jackie in the room, transparent in his pain, alive and dead in Arizona. I dropped her off and picked her up and made sure she had money for the basket. We built pyramids of waste above and below the earth. The more hazardous the waste, the deeper we tried to sink it. The word plutonium comes from Pluto, god of the dead and ruler of the underworld. They took him out to the marshes and wasted him, as we say today, or used to say, until it got changed to something else. I liked to hurry home from the airport and get into my trunks and T-shirt. I ran along the drainage canal with Sufi voices tracking through my head, and sometimes I saw a plane taking off, all light and climb and calculus, and I thought of my son Jeffrey when he was younger. The gift he thought he possessed to take an aircraft out of the sky, the mastery of space and matter, a power and control that rose damnably from the curse of unbelonging. And sometimes I sat with her through the mass in English. What a stark thing it was, without murmur or reverberation. But still the best part of my week. And I took her arm and led her out of the church, and she wasn't a small woman, but seemed to be dwindling, passing episodically out of flesh. She felt like rice paper under my hand. He used to shave with a towel draped over his shoulder, wearing his undershirt, his singlet, and the blade made a noise I liked to listen to. A sandpaper scrape on his heavy beard, and the brush in the shaving cup, the gem blade, and the draped towel in the hot water from the tap, heat and skill and cutting edge. Dominus vobiscum, the priest used to say, and we'd push our way out of the vestibule, several kids chanting, Dominic, go friscum. What was Latin for if you couldn't reduce the formal codes to the jostled argo of the street? It was science fiction stuff, or horror movie stuff, except that Jeff was too shy and frightened to test it in the world, even with his sister whistling in his ear to make the thing explode. Chapter 5. Brian Glassick called late sometimes. He called in streaks late at night, 4 calls in 1 weekend, maybe. And what did he talk about when he called? The office, of course. Bringing up matters he couldn't easily discuss in the tower itself, or the latest national scandal, maybe, with anatomical details. Or he'd carry on about a movie he wanted me to rent. Guns and drugs. He thought it made us better buddies. He also did it as a provocation. Brian believed I was safely encased, solid, with a house and family folded around me, surer than he was, older, but also physically superior, physically fit, a man of hardier stuff. This was his own stated theme, a man who keeps his counsel. And it greatly fazed him. It made him want to chip away, make boyish forays, place claims on my attention. When the phone rang at a certain hour, Marion and I exchanged the Brian look. Had to be him. You will not believe where I am. Get over here right away. This place is astonishing. You're the only person I can bear to share it with. Come alone, he said. It took me a while to find the place. I kept crossing I-10, out where the map begins to go white. Low stucco buildings with satellite dishes, tractor parts and diesel tune-ups, sand and rock and self-defense. Then I spotted a cluster of shops that matched Brian's description. A neat, clean mini-mall, painted sort of rancho pink and green. Three of the outlets not yet open for business. And I parked near the last shop on the left, the only going concern, called Condomology. College kids, gently unkempt. They stood between the shelves talking and browsing, going through the catalogs and reading the small print on the product boxes, and others mixed in, slightly older men and women. They had professions, and soft slacks with knife pleats, and a certain ease of bearing and belonging, the package of attitudes and values known as lifestyle. Brian pushed me into a corner so I could scan the area. Wide aisles. The carpeting was soft and pale, and the aisles were wide. And there were wall paintings. Five panels on each of the two long walls, showing scenes of an ice cream parlor of the 1940s and 50s. A soda jerk behind a marble counter making a strawberry float for a couple of girls in school jerseys and bobby socks. That was one mural, flat painted. Painted in a style not current to the scene. And the effect was interesting. Completely undreamy. Brian was studying my lower jaw for some reaction. I heard music in the deep distance, a crooner doing lost songs, the kind of ballad that sometimes included a verse or two in slurred Italian. And it was all nicely subdued, I thought, unaffected, without patronizing humor. Brian whispered at me sharply, as if I hadn't noticed. Condoms! That's just what it was, all right. Condoms. The whole place was condoms. Shelves filled with 100 kinds of protection, male and female. Spermicides, body butter, latex gloves, silicone lubricants, with books, manuals, videos, special displays, with novelty items of the big dick, little dick type. And T-shirts, of course, and baseball caps with condom logos. And the place is strategically located, out at the new frontier, he said. I can see a satellite city growing out from this one shop. 1,000 buildings. This is my vision, sort of spoked around the condom outlet. Like some medieval town with a castle smack at the center. They build their castles on the periphery. Fuck you. Show some amazement. They have peach-flavored rubbers. And kids come here to socialize, to hang around and see what's doing. I'm waiting to hear Al Hibbler sing Unchained Melody. Al Hibbler was good. Good. Fuck you, good. He was amazing. You think Ray Charles is blind? Al Hibbler, that was blind. Show some response. He led me down an aisle. My response was, look at all these condoms. Studded, snug, ribbed, bareback. We used to say, don't go in bareback, meaning wear a rubber or you'll knock her up. Now there were rubbers called barebacks, electronically tested for sheerness and sensitivity. These will replace running shoes, Brian said. Kids will shoot each other for expensive lambskin condoms. There were loose condoms sold in bowls, in candy jars. Grab a handful. A woman looked at a display model of a polyurethane sheath with flexible rings at either end. Brian knew her from the automated teller machine at his bank. Hello, how are you? Hi, hello. There were finger condoms and full-body condoms. Oral condoms with a minty savor. There were condom cases, pocket-sized, and a condom you could wear as a hat. Brian said, my brother carried a rubber in his wallet all through adolescence. He showed it to me once, I think I was 12, flipped open his wallet and showed me this little wizened thing like a deflated penis, and I don't think I ever recovered. This was a world I wasn't ready to enter. I could understand sex on the animal level. This was something else entirely, something about the material. The plasticky sort of rubber, the look and touch. He made me touch it. And the whole nature and function of the thing. I don't know. It was alien and unsettling. Sex alone was tough enough to encounter. This was technology they wanted to wrap around my dick. This was mass-produced latex they used to paint battleships.
You were a sensitive boy.
I was scrawny and mute, barely human.
You were a strapping kid who beat the crap out of kids like me.
We didn't have any kids like you, I told him.
You carried a rubber?
In the little slit pocket of my dungarees. By the time I was 16, they weren't doing that anymore.
They're doing it now, I said.
I don't think my brother ever used the condom in his wallet. When he got a car, he put it in the car. He put it in the glove compartment. That's when I think he finally got to use it.
A man was singing softly along, crooning the lyrics on the sound system. He moved haltingly toward us, pushing a cylinder of oxygen on wheels. A gray-haired guy, with tubes from the tank running all the way up into his nose. The tank was the size of a dachshund in a custom case. And he sang. He crooned in a rasping voice. He had the phrasing, the timing just right, the lazy line endings, some insipid lyric about a farewell letter, only altered in his gnawed voice to a life-sewn shape, felt in the deepest skin. We moved out of the way to let him pass. Behind the products and their uses, we glimpsed the industry of vivid description. Dermasilk and Astroglide and Reservoir Tipped. There were condoms packaged as Roman coins and condoms in matchbook folders. Brian read aloud from the copy on the boxes. We had natural animal membranes and bubblegum scenting. We had condoms that glowed in the dark, and foreplay condoms, and condoms marked with graffiti that stretched to your erection. A letter becoming a word that expands to a phrase. He did a little Churchill. We shall wear them on the beaches. We had lollipop condoms. We had boxer shorts printed with cartoon characters shaped like condoms standing on end, sort of floaty and nipple-headed, who spoke a language called Spermian. A young woman stood near the door, a Ramsey's logo tattooed on her earlobe.
My kid's got one of those, Brian said. Only it says Pepsi. Should I be grateful?
Which kid?
Which kid? What's the difference?
Brian was wary of his family. He adopted the put-upon pose of the father complaining routinely about kids who are careless with money and forgetful of every caution. We all have this act we perform. It amounts to a second language, the dad's easy-to-master lament. And Brian did scornful solos of high animation. But he also harbored something deeper and sadder, a sense that these were his enemies, forces loose in his own house, prepared to drain him of self-worth. A stepdaughter, a daughter, and a son, all in high school, and a wife, he said, who was a couple of bubbles off-center.
That's not the only thing she's got planted on her body.
Which kid? I said.
Brittany.
I like Brittany. Be nice to her.
Be nice to her. Listen to this. She wears an armband. You won't believe this. They had apartheid simulation day at her school.
What's that?
What it says. They attempt to simulate the culture of apartheid. A lesson for the kids. They all wore armbands. You were gold if you were the oppressed class, and I think red if you were the military, and green if you were the elite.
Brittany volunteered for the oppressed class. And now she won't take her armband off. The official simulation lasted one day, but she's been doing this for weeks now. Nobody else is doing this but her. She restricts her access to the lunchroom 10 minutes a day. She only rides certain buses at certain times. She sits in a specified area of the classroom.
How do the other kids react?
She gets spat upon and shunned. He made a TV screen with his hands, thumbs horizontal, index fingers upright, and he looked out at me from inside the frame, eyes crossed, tongue lolling in his head. We took a final turn around the room.
A boy and girl in one of the murals sat in a booth with ice cream sundaes and frosty glasses of water and long-handled spoons for the sundaes, and the scene was not contrived to be charming, but was close to documentary in tone. And the whole place was a little museum-like, I thought, with time compressed and objects arrayed of evolutionary interest. And a woman sang a ballad about a chapel in the moonlight, vaguely familiar to me. And I turned to see if the man with the oxygen tank was still singing along. Brian bought a package of condoms to give to his son, David, a buddy-buddy thing, a token of communication and accord. We went outside and stood in the empty plaza, and he opened the box and removed a single sheath in its foil wrap. He looked at it. He had a sputter laugh he saved for certain occasions, like a semi-drowned man, bitter about being rescued. And he looked at the thing and laughed. Everybody talked about VD then. The clap was a term with a very decisive ring to it. The clap. The sif. All those terms, one worse than the other. But I couldn't detect a saving element in a condom. Maybe because it brought to mind another term. Scumbag. And in my little retard sort of 12-year-old brain, maybe I sensed a secret life in this object in my brother's wallet, this scumbag. How could a thing called a scumbag be safe to use? We're waste managers, I told him. Scumbags are things we deal with. But think of the contempt we invest in this word. It's an ugly word, full of self-loathing. Never mind the words. You bought a rubber for your kid because it's important for him to use it. I hate to be sensible. I know it's thankless to be sensible in the face of someone's primitive distrust. You're right. People have to use these things. You're right, he said. It's thankless. He unwrapped the condom and shook it out until the nipple end swung lightly in the breeze. Then he crumpled the thing in his fist and held it to his nose. He said, what does it smell like? Is it shower curtains? Is it car upholstery or lampshade liner? Is it those big blocky garment bags where you store the clothes you never wear? He was inhaling deeply, trying to absorb the odor, retain it fully so he might mark its nature. His lean head flared, red-roostered. He thought it might be the smell of the bubble wrap around your new computer when you take it out of the shipping container. Or the shipping container itself. Or the computer itself. Or the plastic baggies that have been in your freezer too long, collecting Freon fumes. He thought it might be a hospital smell, a laboratory smell, a discharge from a chemical plant. He couldn't place it exactly. The insulation in your walls. The filter in your air conditioner. I thought they were odor-free, modern condoms, I said. Except when flavor is added. That's the new type that's odor-free. I bought them the old cheap latex that binds the sex member and reduces the sensation and smells bad. Because I want him to pay a price for being sensible. Marion sat in Jeff's room watching a movie on TV. I had to adjust to the sight of someone else in his room. His room was his animal den, his pelt and smell. And I thought she was committing some breach of species, sitting in there. She wore beat-up jeans and an old tank top that drooped in front. The kind of woman who grows into her beauty, I think, who becomes beautiful over time, and then one day you see it, sort of suddenly and altogether. It becomes a local scandal of surprise and comment. When did you start smoking again? Shut up, she said. I told her about condomology. I stood in the doorway and talked above the noise from the movie. She was fine-skinned, assertive in a way that was all featural, slightly angular of face, straight-nosed, dark-haired, no-nonsense-looking, very near classical in an American way, a certain sort of old-fashioned way that doesn't stray drastically from plainness, like the face cut in raised relief on the old soap bar. Maybe it was Camé. I'm not sure. The woman's head in profile with marcelled hair, although Marion's was straight. Where's Jeff?
Went out. I'm watching this.
I told her about apartheid simulation day, standing in the doorway. She said,
I'm watching this.
Want something? I want something.
Mineral water would be nice, she said.
I went to the kitchen and got all the things out of all the compartments. I poured the mineral water over ice in a tall glass and dropped a wedge of lemon in. Got the potato vodka from the freezer, smoky cold, and remembered what it was I wanted to say to her. I cut a loon of lemon skin and dropped it in a port glass. I wanted to say something about Brian. I had tried drinking port for a while, just to see how it would feel, how it would sound, a port glass, a fortified wine. And now I use the port glass for my vodka, pouring it syrupy, cold, and opal. I heard the dialogue from the movie at the other end of the house. Her skin was camé pure, and her hair was dark and straight, and she usually wore it short, because short was easy. Her voice was shaped. It was deep and toned, sort of vowel-round and erotic. Particularly over the phone, or in the bedroom dark, with brandy static in it, or just the slightest throaty thing of night desire. She used to sing in a church choir in her Big Ten town, she liked to call it, but quit over some belittlement, some perceived slight. How she would hate to hear me say perceived. I handed her the mineral water, and she said something about Brian. I thought she might be trying to preempt my own Brian remark. She felt it coming in the routine reading of signals in the marriage sense-around. Did he recommend another movie where everybody ends up in a storm sewer shooting each other? This is how Brian relieves the pressure of being Brian. I remembered a party where she stuck herself in a corner of the room with a man we both knew slightly, a university poet with long, raked hair and stained teeth, laughing. He talked, she laughed. Innocent enough, you say. Or not innocent at all, but completely acceptable. A party's a party, and if the huddle went on far too long, who was to notice but the husband? And I said to her later, this was a long time ago when the kids were small and Marion drove a car without a pencil in her hand. I said to her later, self-importantly, because this was the point, to speak with exaggerated dignity, to speak to the depths of my being, and make fun of myself at the same time, because this is what we do at parties. I said, I suffer from a rare condition that afflicts Mediterranean men. It's called self-respect. I stood in the doorway watching the movie with her. Will Jeff be living with us forever, do you think?
Could happen.
The job at the Dyer Ranch fell through?
I guess.
He didn't say?
I'm watching this, she said.
Did you do the newspapers?
I did the bottles. Tomorrow's bottle day. Let me watch this, she said.
We'll both watch it.
You don't know what's going on. I've been watching for an hour and a quarter.
I'll catch up.
I don't want to sit here and explain.
You don't have to say a word.
The movie's not worth explaining, she said.
I'll catch up by watching.
But you're interfering, she said.
I'll be quiet and I'll watch.
You're interfering by watching, she said.
The remark pleased her. It had a tinge of insight, and she stretched, smiling in a sort of coiled yawn, hips and legs steady, upper body bent away. I guess I knew what she meant, that another's presence screws up the steady balance, the integrated company of the box. She wanted to be alone with a bad movie, and I was standing judgment. You work too hard, I told her.
I love my job. Shut up.
Now that I've stopped working too hard, you work too hard.
I'm watching this.
You work unnecessarily hard.
If he tries to kill her, I'm going to be very upset.
Maybe he'll kill her off camera.
Off camera, fine. He can use a chainsaw, as long as I don't have to see it.
I watched until my glass was empty. I went back to the kitchen and turned off the light. Then I went into the living room and looked at the peach sienna sofa. It was a new piece, a thing to look at and absorb, a thing the room would incorporate over time. It took the curse off the piano. We had a piano no one played, one of Marion's Big Ten heirlooms, an object like a mounted bearskin, oppressing all of us with its former life. I turned off the light in the living room, but first I looked at the books on the shelves. I stood in the room, looking at the peach sienna sofa and the Rajasthani wall hanging and the books on the shelves. Then I turned off the light. Then I checked the other light, the light in the back hall, to make sure it was still on in case my mother had to get up during the night. I stood in the doorway again. Marion watched TV, body and soul. She lit another cigarette, and I went into the bedroom. I stood looking at the books on the shelves. Then I got undressed and went to bed. She came in about 15 minutes later. I waited for her to start undressing. What do I detect?
What do you mean?
She said. Between you and Brian.
What do you mean? She said.
What do I detect? That's what I mean.
He makes me laugh,
she said finally. He makes his wife laugh, too, but I don't detect anything between them. She thought about ways to reply to this. It was an amusing remark, perhaps, but not what I'd intended. She looked at me and walked out of the room. I heard the shower running across the hall, and I realized I'd done it all wrong. I should have brought up the subject standing in the doorway while she was watching TV. Then I could have been the one who walks out of the room. Chapter 6. We laid in a case of the flavored seltzer she liked, and we set her up in a quiet room, Laney's old room, with the re-silvered mirror and the big-screen TV. It wasn't long before Jeff stopped wearing the baggy shorts and turnaround cap and began to resemble himself again. His personal computer had a multimedia function that allowed him to look at a copy of the famous videotape showing a driver being shot by the Texas highway killer. Jeff became absorbed in these images, devising routines and programs, using filtering techniques to remove background texture. He was looking for lost information. He enhanced and super-slowed, trying to find some pixel in the data swarm that might provide a clue to the identity of the shooter. The device weighed only 3.5 ounces, and it showed the distance I ran and the calories I burned and even the length of the strides I took, clipped to the waistband of my trunks. I was 11 years old when he went out for cigarettes. A warm evening with men playing pinochle inside a storefront club and radio voices everywhere on the street. Someone's always playing a radio. And they took him out near Orchard Beach, where the shoreline is crannied with remote inlets. And they dropped him into the lower world, his body suspended above the rockweed in the soft, organic murk. Not that I really recall the weather or the card players. There's always a radio and someone playing cards. At home, we wanted clean, safe, healthy garbage. We rinsed out old bottles and put them in their proper bins. We faithfully removed the crinkly paper from our cereal boxes. It was like preparing a pharaoh for his death and burial. We wanted to do the small things right. He never committed a figure to paper. He had a head for numbers, a memory for numbers. We fixed her up with the humidifier, the hangers, the good hard bed, and the dresser that belonged to Marion when she was growing up, a handsome piece with a history behind it. In the bronze tower, I looked out at the umber hills and felt assured and well defended, safe in my office box,
and my crisp white shirt, and connected to things that made me stronger. In the bronze tower, a fellow executive cleared his throat, and I heard something go by in the small, hoarse noise. A secret linger of childhood, the game he played inside his life. Maybe it was 108 degrees out on the street. He was spying on himself. The third person watches the first person. The he spies on the I. The he knows things the I can't bear to think about. Maybe it was 110, 112, telephones warbling in modulated phrases. The third person sends his nobody to kill the first person's somebody. I used to say when they were small, I told them more than once, this is the washer, this is the packing, this is the spout. In the Bronze Tower, we use the rhetoric of aggrieved minorities to prevent legislation that would hurt our business. Arthur Blessing believed, our CEO, that true feeling flows upward from the streets, fully accessible to corporate adaptation. We learned how to complain, how to appropriate the language of victimization. Arthur listened to gangster rap on the car radio every morning. Songs about getting mad and getting laid and getting even, taking what's rightfully ours by violent means if necessary. He believed this was the only form of address that made an impact on Washington. Arthur recited lyrics to me once on the company plane, and together we laughed his wacko laugh, those enunciated ha-has, clear and slow and well-spaced, like laughing with words. Coming home, I liked to put suntan lotion on my arms, face, and legs, and go running down the quiet streets of oleanders and palms, and along the drainage canal banked with red dirt. I ran in dense heat and strong light, and I thought about the protection factor bumping up to 60 now. I wondered about this even though I'm olive-skinned, dark as my old man. From 15 to 30 to 60, where once upon a time a factor 15 was the absolute maximum sunblock scientifically possible. Running past tree trunks limed white against the unrelenting sun. You have to cut it thick. That's what he said about the bread. The round, crusty loaf he called Campobasso bread, after the name of the store, which itself was named for a mountain town on the spine of Italy. The best bread, you cut it too thin, he said, it's worthless. I watched him shave, and I watched him cut bread, holding the loaf on its side with one hand, thumb of the other hand, the knife hand, edged over the haft onto the back of the blade to guide the slicing. Down through the crust and into the springy middle of the bread. When Lainey had her baby, her girl, I felt a soft joy settle in my chest. Or a solace, maybe, an easing of some perennial clutch or grab, some taunt of malehood. All these women now, from my mother in her pale green room to this raw arrival kicking in mortal fret, all gathered near the chimney-piece. It was a kindness that the child should be a girl. I felt an expansive ease, an unthrobbing of some knot in my body. I watched her naked in her mother's arms, swimming in a ribbon of light. Tuesdays we only did plastic, minus caps and lids. Waste is an interesting word that you can trace through Old English and Old Norse back to the Latin, finding such derivatives as empty, void, vanish, and devastate. Residents of Phoenix are called Phoenicians. They talked about the things I didn't talk about. Although I told her about the stolen car, and we said to each other, Marion and I, we said if people ever saw our son in the commission of a crime, they wouldn't know how to describe him, except for his skin color and the jokey sticker fastened to the rear bumper of his Honda. If, in fact, his Honda was an element of the crime, the bumper sticker someone gave him going nowhere fast. Marion and I saw products as garbage, even when they sat gleaming on store shelves, yet unbought. We didn't say, what kind of casserole will that make? We said, what kind of garbage will that make? Safe, clean, neat, easily disposed of? Can the package be recycled and come back as a tawny envelope that is difficult to lick closed? First we saw the garbage. Then we saw the product as food or light bulbs or dandruff shampoo. How does it measure up as waste, we asked. We asked whether it is responsible to eat a certain item if the package the item comes in will live a million years. According to street legend, he never wrote a number on a piece of paper. Night after night we sat in the stale glow, my mother and I, and watched reruns of The Honeymooners. Ralph crammed and wailing his unstoppable pain. Maybe my mother identified with wife Alice. The apron and cloth coat, an underfurnished flat, and food smells in the hallway. But Alice had a bus driver husband who kept walking in the door instead of going out. He drove a vehicle licensed by society. And Ralph and Alice had no kids to worry and torment them. You had the kids without the husband. Not even a body, risen from the rockweed and found floating by two guys early one Sunday in a rented rowboat with a cage for trapping crabs. The nibbled body of Jimmy Costanza, age whatever. I went back to the coastal lowlands of Texas and did an interview with the BBC. Wearing a hard hat and miner's lamp and standing in a salt passage 2,000 feet under the earth. The producer stood off camera and asked questions, and I tasted salt dust stirred up by the forklifts and tried to frame responses that would please her. You had the man who did the job unlicensed by society. In the hallways and alleys you heard the footfalls at night and must have wondered if that was Jimmy coming back. From the dead, or the dark, or maybe just New Jersey. And that was you, dressing quickly at first light before the heat came whistling up the pipes. Early mass among the Italians in their grave clothes. You had the kids with their taut nerves, the little wood-pushing wonder who was harder to love than a handful of coffee dregs. Alone those cold mornings going to mass, and the older son, with his distance and dimmed moods and undimmed rage, up on the roof in the evening sleet to smoke a cigarette. I look at the Lucky Strike logotype, and I think Target. I watched men in moon suits bury drums of nuclear waste, and I thought of the living rocks down there. The subterranean process. The half-life. The atoms that decay to half the original number. The most common isotope of uranium is bombarded with neutrons to produce plutonium that fissions, if we can generate a verb from the energy of splitting atoms. This isotope has the mass number 238. Add the digits and you get 13. But the bombs were not released. I remember Clarice Sachs talking about the men who flew the strategic bombers as we all stood listening in the long, low structure of sectioned concrete. The missiles remained in the rotary launchers. The men came back, and the cities were not destroyed.
This ends Disc 4.